It's showtime.
Kincaid, 3 hours of conversation cussing and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy. And here we go. We are off and running for this, the 19th day of March, 2018. This is The Horn. HeadOn.live is where we live, while HeadOnRadioNetwork.com remains in suspended animation. Still waiting on word from John Fox on what's going on there. That's just a mess. But, hey, we're here. And the streams are, I presume, as soon as I do the other thing that I forgot to do, namely, engage the other computer. I presume that we're live and streaming. It looks like we are, via both the White Rose Society stream and the HeadOn.live stream. So that'll mean things like FYI Nation and Roku and Stitcher and TuneIn Radio and what have you should all be banging on all eight cylinders. So that's a very good thing. It's the beginning of the week. The beginning of another brand new broadcast week. And we are streaming live and hot and true. So hot diggity dog. It's also, in addition to being the 19th, it's a Monday. And we, of course, know that Mondays have special meanings here at the Horn. Oh, yes. For it's the day that the Morans come out to play. Before we jump into the meat of the program, of course, we have gratitude to express. Yes. Thanks going out to the subscribers who helped keep this program on the air and who managed to knock down about a quarter of the month's funding in any given month. So thanks. Thanks go out to an anonymous friend in Maryland. Some people like to remain anonymous. Thanks very kindly to Robert in Iowa. Thank you, Robert. And thanks to Joseph in Ohio. Thanks very kindly to Dave in Ohio, who I get emails from Dave talking about the laughter this program occasions for him, and it's very, very gratifying to know that. And thanks very kindly to Mike in Cascadia. Thank you very kindly, Mike. It's much appreciated. Meanwhile, thanks. We continue to offer thanks to our friends at our friend at Cat Mountain Arts. Thank you very kindly to Charlene in Rhode Island. Thank you, Charlene. Thank you to Grace in New York. Thank you very, very much indeed. And thank you to Joan in Tallahassee. Thank you very, very much indeed. Thanks as well to Nancy in New York. Thank you, Nancy. Thank you to Arthur in Arizona. And thanks to Gary Laborman off in New Mexico. Thanks also go out to Henry from the other night. Thank you, Henry. And thank you to Les up in Massachusetts. So, all things being equal, that leaves us for this evening with a fundraising goal somewhere around the neighborhood of $230, because we didn't quite knock it all down last Friday night. So we got $230 to go this evening, and, well, hopefully we'll do that so that we won't have a big old $430 hole tomorrow night that turns into a $630 hole Wednesday night, et cetera. But, the good news is if we do all our fundraising for this week, that means we've got a rock-solid week of fundraising-free radio, which always excites me. So we'll start counting down with the $230 this evening. Okey-doke, okey-doke. So now, it really is, it's Moran Monday. As Clarity points out, a whole weekend of nonsense and mind-numbing malignancy at the Ship of State's brain mass. Spirochetes are people, too. Have you hugged a spirochete today? Well, don't. They're invasive and pushy, and they don't like to leave. And it requires massive amounts of things like, antibiotics. But anyway, yes, it has been a Looney Tunes week end. And that's why we put more ends on Monday around here. Oh, yeah. So the general stuff applies. If you want to help out with fundraising, go over to headon.live, headon.live. Scroll down. There's a PayPal button there. Please feel free to use it. We'd love to have new subscribers. Like I said, subscribers knocked down about a quarter of the funding for the month. If we ever got to the point where we had enough subscribers to just take care of it all, these monumental chunks of time that are spent talking about fundraising would go away. Yes. So there's that. Anyway, headon.live, there's a PayPal button. And, of course, if you'd like to be a subscriber and you hate PayPal, you can always go over to Patreon, patreon.com/Bob Kincaid, BOBKINCAID. And the Patreon contributions only come out on the first day of the month. So that way maybe it's a little easier to plan for. Mailing address for folks who like them to use the U.S. Postal Service? Well, that's The Horn, 1038 North Eisenhower Drive, PMB 318, Beckley, BECKLEY, WV 25801. All right, that takes care of everything, I think. Okay? Yeah. So, that being the case, yes, it is... it's Moran Monday, and, that means things.
You've got to remember that these are just simple farmers. These are people of the land. Morons.
That's right, friends and neighbors, with the sound of the calliope, you know that it's that time, Moran Monday, on the Horn, just a few mere steps away from the Carnival Midway, the biggest bargain
inside the carnival fences. Yes, indeed, that's the Moran Monday tent over here, just a few steps away from where just moments ago you were throwing ping pong balls at goldfish bowls in the hope of winning a tiny little iguana that you can take home and then hate. Yes, friends, that's the way it is here in the carnival. We've got them all for you here this evening. We absolutely do. We've got your birthers, your deathers, your ninthers, your baggers, your birchers, your booger eaters, chimpanzees, maggots, all Republicans, libertarians. They're all here for your delectation on Moran Monday on the Horn. You can't tell the Morans without a program. And this is the program that tells the Morans. You just can't tell them much. That's right, for less than 16 cents an hour of programming for a $10 a month subscriber, well, you get them all. You get them all right here every Monday, and frankly, the Tuesday program, the Wednesday program, the Thursday program, and the Friday program. All for less money than you can actually buy anything for down to the Rippy Mart. Okie dokie. Friends and neighbors, aunts and uncles, kitties and cousins, come on up. Wander inside the thin cybernetic veil of the Moran Monday tent and be amazed, be horrified, be shocked, be sickened, be stunned. Be here. But do, as you go through, remember to please keep a close watch and a close eye and a close hand on wallets, purses, children, small animals, even that iguana you won throwing ping pong balls at goldfish bowls, because, and especially European-style messenger bags, because the Morans can get grabby. Oh, yes. Yes, they absolutely can. As we move into Moran Monday, our buddy Silent R. Lamar says, "Come on, people, help. Keep this going." Thank you, Silent R. Lamar. Thank you very, very kindly indeed. Where to begin? Well, how about we begin in our nation's capital, shall we? Mm-hmm. Well, not necessarily in the nation's capital, but with the federal government, and particularly the judiciary. It's not actually in Washington, D.C. that we're looking, but instead to the Circuit Court. In particular, the 5th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals. They have jurisdiction, that court does, over Louisiana, among other places. You can tell where this is going. Louisiana, Mississippi, Texas. That's your 5th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals. That's one of those courts of appeals that you go to when you really absolutely have to have some Republican hatchet work done inside the court system. This, of course, cannot be referred to as action by activist judges, because only liberals are activist judges. Only Democratic nominees and appointees can be activist judges. But regardless, last week, toward the end of the week, the 5th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals, by a 2-1 margin, ruled on a Labor Department rule from the previous administration, you know, the Kenyan Muslim usurper who lived in our White House, yes. And it was a horrible rule. It was a terrible rule. It was an absolute disaster in the waiting. Yes. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce had filed the suit, so that gives you another idea of where this is going. The U.S. Labor Department, under Barack Obama's administration, had promulgated a rule that said... No, I'm not kidding. That said that financial advisors actually had to act and give advice in the best interest of their clients. Disgusting, isn't it? I mean, imagine a financial advisor who, you know, has a profound impact on your money being compelled by law not to screw you all the way to the mat. Well, this was something up with which the United States Chamber of Commerce would not put, and so they took it to court. And it found its way into the 5th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals, where, by a ruling of 2-1, that Circuit Court of Appeals said, "Why, heavens to Murgatroyd, we can't have the jackbooted government putting its jackboot down on the neck of innocent little financial advisors who don't want to do anything but think of themselves instead of their clients. Gracious sakes, what would happen? What would happen to the free market if that was to go down? Golly Moses." Mm-hmm. No, this really happened. I'm not kidding. The two people who put the wood to this otherwise sane sort of a rule were Judge Edith Clement. And Judge Edith Jones. Judge Edith Jones has been on the bench since the Reagan administration, so that gives you an idea of what, yeah. So just remember, in killing this rule, well, if you seek the advice of a financial advisor in this here country, Merca, the greatest country in the history of the world on earth now today in the universe forever under God, just remember that that said financial advisor does not have to have your best interests at heart when he or she renders financial advice. In fact, the financial advisor could render advice that winds up being terrible for you, but is great for his down payment on his new Porsche. Because freedom. Yes, freedom. You know, sooner or later, everything is going to move into the into the realm of that occupied by the people who pitch bullshit nutritional supplements. Mm-hmm. Oh, yes. Oh, yes. And that's why I'm proud to tell you this evening about something new from Horn Nutraceuticals at Horn Labs on Twitter. Yes, that's right. I'm talking right now to you about Mirabilia Dictu. Can you even believe that it's come to this? No one else has this out there for the kind of pricing plans that we do. I'm talking about creatic kraut. Yes, creatic kraut from Horn Nutraceuticals at Horn Labs on Twitter is a proprietary blend of entirely fermented and then freeze-dried and then ground up and desiccated sauerkraut, creatic kraut, which we then put in capsules and provide to you, the credulous who are simple enough to purchase it. Yes, yes, creatic kraut from Horn Nutraceuticals at Horn Labs on Twitter is in fact a proprietary blend. And among other things, it's soy-free and gluten-free. It's also probiotic. And it has a wide variety of nutritional benefits, any of which, and it has any nutritional benefit which you yourself might imagine. because that's the key with Creatic Kraut from Horn Nutraceuticals at Horn Labs on Twitter. Yes, your ability to imagine that it's doing anything for you whatsoever. Creatic Kraut is, of course, free range and cage-free, cruelty-free, gluten-free, vegan, and free of any nutritional benefit whatsoever. Try Creatic Kraut today, only from Horn Labs, at Horn Labs on Twitter, Horn Nutraceuticals, the hardworking periodontic peripatetic scientists there. Really hope you will. Because, well, I've always been a big fan of kraut. But with Creatic Kraut from Horn Nutraceuticals at Horn Labs on Twitter, I can have it all day, every day. And yes, yes, a 3-month supply, if you order it right now, using the code word Bob in the coupon box, well, we'll send you a 90-day supply of Creatic Kraut for only $230 plus shipping and handling of another $800 or so. And we'll, of course, send you the little credulity strips that we send along with every order so that you can open up one of the little capsules, pour it on it, and say, "Holy smokes, I've been had! This capsule is empty!" Because, yes, as Steve in New York wonders, is it kraut-free? It is absolutely kraut-free. It's even capsule-free. It's everything but monetarily free. Yes, order the Creatic Kraut right now, and we will not send you that 90-day supply, and you won't have to worry about it. You'll just know that, once again, you've been had because you bought Creatic Kraut, a bullshit nutritional supplement from somebody on the radio. Yes, by the way, did I also mention that Creatic Kraut is paleo? Yes, it's paleo Creatic Kraut. Take my word for it, I'm a guy on the radio. Creatic Kraut from Horn Nutraceuticals at Horn Labs on Twitter. Post no bills, use no hooks, COD, FOB, this side up, that side down, probiotic, gluten-free, soy-free, and paleo Creatic Kraut, K-R-A-U-T. Creatic Kraut from Horn Nutraceuticals at Horn Labs on Twitter. And see what I just did there? Well, you can put as much faith into, thanks to the Fifth United States Circuit Court of Appeals, you can put as much faith into what I said as you can into anything a financial advisor says in this country now, because they're not bound by any sort of law to actually advise you in your best interests, because that would make our economy, I guess, collapse or give some hustler on Wall Street a sad or something like that. Imagine if you went out and hired a lawyer and said, I need you to defend me in a murder case. And the lawyer said, okay, that'll be $150,000, and you ponied up the money. And the lawyer immediately ran over to the prosecution and said, hey, I got the goods. He did it. Here, you want to see? You want to hear the recording? I got it. Well, that's pretty much where we are with financial advisors. Yeah, they can shiv you, and it won't even matter. It's a beautiful thing, isn't it? Not so much. Meanwhile, note coming in from Bill in Allentown, a reminder. It's been 15 years since the reign of error started the war crimes to begin the century. I was sick all day that day because every time I turned on the TV, my eyes fell on Bush's war crimes. Gosh, it feels like only yesterday that we were launching an entirely unnecessary war of choice against the innocent people of Iraq who had never done a damn thing to us. Over stuff that didn't exist. You know, weapons of mass destruction. And who can ever forget those stirring images of Colin Powell flushing his credibility down the toilet as he said, "This is not conjecture, these are facts. Look at this mobile rocket launcher that was actually a riding lawnmower," or something like that. Doesn't time fly when you're committing war crimes? No, it got a little warm today, Jim, but not that warm. It's a nice 72 degrees in the studio here, and in point of fact, this is not naked radio. But, you know, hey, Jim, thanks for caring, I think. Mm-hmm. Well, okay, yeah. So many questions coming from the analytic mind of Steve in New York, a member of the Fraternity of Steve. And, of course, all the other members of the Fraternity of Steve can take credit for this. Steve wants to know, yeah, sure, it's paleo, but is it Jurassic, Neolithic? By God, Steve, it's Cretaceous. It's Mesozoic. We actually have, we have petrified kraut from petrified cabbage from millions and millions and millions of years ago. Yes. So we've got that from the magnificent Fifth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals. You can, I wonder how the U.S. Chamber of Commerce brought that suit, but I wonder how the certified financial advisors out there feel about it now that they've had their credibility flushed down the toilet. Yeah. And let me clear this one off the desk, too. This is utterly unrelated. But it, well, no, it's not unrelated because it also comes out of the court system. But this isn't out of the federal system. This is out of the California court system. So we all remember who Richard Simmons was. I remember who he was going all the way back to the great Luke and Laura romance on General Hospital. God, that was only a billion years ago. I think stars have burned out since then. A fitness guru, and a very peppy and bubbly one at that. None of the grimness of, say, a Jack LaLanne. Well, Richard decided to go off the radar for a little while. I guess he just wanted to be left alone for a little while. And this then spawned all kinds of weird-ass speculation over, oh my God, what's happened to Richard? Because, you know, in the United States of America, if you just want to be left alone, well, you have no right to that. And so after you know, flying under the radar and away from the radar and whatnot, a few media outlets decided to start publishing wholly false claims about Richard Simmons. This includes the National Enquirer, whose publisher and owner is a dear friend of Geezer Disgustus. And among other things, they published, the National Enquirer did, with a really weird doctored-up photograph and a big, splashy, bold tabloid headline, Richard Simmons, he's now a woman. Call me Fiona, inside her bizarre new world. Unmasked, why she's the new Caitlyn Jenner. Exposed, secret boob job and castration surgery. Yes, the photo shoot is real. The real reason he disappeared for 924 days. World exclusive! I usually don't go in for this sort of celebrity gossip drama, really. But here, there's a reason for it. Not a word of it was true. And about 10 months ago, Richard Simmons sued Radar Online, American Media, National Enquirer, after these articles alleging that he was transgendered, is transgendered, were published. and as necessary under the law, Richard Simmons alleged in his complaint that these stories were published by these outlets with calculated malice. In the suit papers, there was an allegation that read as follows. This case is about a particularly egregious and hurtful campaign of defamations and privacy invasions, falsely asserting that Mr. Simmons is transitioning from a male to a female, including, quote-unquote, shocking sex surgery, breast implants, hormone treatments, and consultations on medical castrations. Richard Simmons went on to say that most of these salacious details came from a former assistant who he then went on to claim has blackmailed, extorted, and stalked him, and was the source of the claims, which, I repeat, he asserts are false. Now, we all know that the libel laws are decidedly lax in this country, that you have to show things like actual malice, and that's why that calculated malice line was in there. Well, here's where it gets weird. The L.A. County Superior Court judge who heard the case, Gregory Keosian, finally ruled about a week ago. He had previously dismissed the lawsuit, and he then entered an order compelling Richard Simmons to pay the lawyers for the National Enquirer having published an entirely false story about him. And the rationale is troubling. So Richard Simmons says, I'm not trans. They said I'm trans, I'm not trans, and they said it only for the purposes of selling newspapers with no even tangential relationship to the truth. Okay, point well taken. We're having a grammar moment here, courtesy of Clarity. Transgender, not transgendered. I would call you male or Agnes female, please. Okay, I get it. Well, here's the rationale from the judge. He dismissed this suit based on entirely dishonest gossip. It's not even reporting. Because Richard Simmons said he had been subjected to hatred, contempt, ridicule, and obloquy as a result of the false and arguably malicious statements of the National Enquirer and Radar Online and American media. Judge Gregory Keosian of the L.A. County Superior Court disagreed, saying, while as a practical matter, the characteristic may be held in contempt by a portion of the population, the court will not validate those prejudices by legally recognizing them. I'm guessing this is opinion. I'm guessing the judge is being straightforward in that statement, that we do not want to create a legal holding that accusing someone of being transgender constitutes a libel. because we wish to, as a statement of public policy, destigmatize such gender-related issues. I'm not so sure, as a practitioner of the art of word-knowing, how I feel about describing the phenomenon of being transgender as a characteristic. I mean, I guess it is. One may be transgender the same way that one may be blue-eyed or brown-eyed, left-handed or right-handed. Those are all characteristics. But it seems that Judge Keyesian lives in a very different world. Here's what makes this case bizarre. Necessarily, it was filed in Southern California. And this is not, I'm certainly not some weird-ass right-wing broadcaster. Yeah, well, California don't share our heartland middle American values of burning crosses in people's yards. It is attitudinal. But consider that if Richard Simmons had filed this case in, say, Bug Tussle Circuit Court in Mississippi, Stan, he might have prevailed. Because a jury there, had it gotten the case, might have said, yeah, saying someone's transgender? That could ruin a career. That could be the end of one's public persona. That could create a media circus around a person that would keep them from ever wanting to so much as set foot outside their door. This actually is a little bit of judicial activism. Because the question was not whether or not the judge thought it exposed Richard Simmons to obloquy, to be falsely outed as transgender. The question was whether that materially false statement was published with, as Simmons' lawyers asserted, calculated malice. And that's, that's a different question entirely. So on the one hand, you've got a judge trying to do the right thing and drag us a little further along in terms of human evolution by saying he won't legally recognize the prejudice of people who think that there's something wrong with people who are transgender. But at the same time, denying justice to someone who has been materially harmed. And make no mistake, Richard Simmons was harmed. But this is not a country in which we can say that being labeled as transgender is prima facie not injurious. There are lots of places where it is. And I don't mean just hurt your feelings injurious, or maybe make it less economically viable for you to have some sort of work injurious. I'm talking about places in this country, and the stories are there practically every week, where being transgender can get you dead real fast. Outside a bar, be assaulted inside a restaurant, kicked, stomped, beaten, shot, knifed, cut, raped. But it appears that Judge Keyosian must live in some walled and gated community where that never happens to transgender people. And so, in an attempt to do the right thing in one regard, L.A. Superior Court Judge Gregory Keyosian did manifest harm in another. And what's more, he gave a free hand to the National Enquirer to do whatever it wishes and publish whatever it wishes without regard to right or wrong. And that kind of matters. So I thought I thought that needed to be mentioned. It probably wasn't way up high in the hierarchy of big breaking news stories, but well, you know, yay! I guess in Judge Keyosian's neighborhood, there's no stigma attached. But sadly, he doesn't live in the rest of America. Clarity. I'm trying to understand what you're getting at there. Just a couple of one-word messages. Yeah. Oh, okay. I left out in the list of things that are done to transgender people, I left out drowned, because drowned is there too. Maybe someday we'll get to it, but look, we are 55 years on as of this August from the massive gathering on the Washington Mall at which Dr. King delivered his I Have a Dream speech. And we have bombs going off in Austin, Texas, that have killed people of color. I saw someone, and of course there was another bomb over the weekend. This time, instead of being mailed or delivered, it had a tripwire attached to it. So the bomber is using varied methods. And that would tend to point to the fact that even though someone with the august majesty of the law attached to their name says something, it doesn't necessarily mean, it doesn't translate to a socio-politico-cultural reality. And I saw someone mentioning the Austin bombings earlier today and said that it reminded them of the Unabomber. Well, that in turn got me thinking. I thought, no, this doesn't remind me of the Unabomber. This reminds me of Birmingham, Alabama, 1963. Things like the 16th Street Baptist Church bombing. And yeah, I wonder, will people provide clippings to Judge Keyesian every time a transgender person is harmed, attacked, killed? Just to remind him that bigots don't much care whether he gives sanction to something in a legal ruling. It's worth it, you know. It's one of those little cultural crossroads where you, you just wonder how it'll play out, and you feel bad for somebody like Richard Simmons, who was denied a legal recourse. The jury never even got to hear the case. The judge just decided for them. Jim asks, legal relief? Surely yes. Sorry, no. Not only does he not get relief, he has to pay $220,000 to the lawyers for the National Enquirer because they, or their client, because their client defamed him. But I guess that is a larger question. Is it defamation? This is going to sound crazy. I've got a pair of pastel-colored jeans. I like them. I like color, as I've said before. And I was in the store the other day, walking away, and I just heard a voice behind me. It was like, faggot! And I turned around, and he grinned. Was I defamed? Yes. Was that hateful? Yes. But Judge Keyesian, what was his phrase there? Will not validate those prejudices by legally recognizing them. Moreover, he said, just saying someone's transgender doesn't inherently expose someone to hatred, contempt, ridicule, or obloquy. Yes, it does. Welcome to life on Earth, Judge. And what am I going to do? Turn around in the store and make a scene? And, you know, punch the dude's lights out? Mama always said it was easy. It took more courage to walk away from the fight than to stand and be in one. So just another little day. Just a little day in America. Yeah. Yeah, we have days all over the place. They had a day in Montana. The Missoulian publication. Reporting on John Gibney, G-I-B-N-E-Y. Remember, this is More in Monday. John Gibney is a candidate for political office. And he's 72 years old. Turns out that people like, well, he's got a history. Back in 2016, he attended a rally and got to having a chat with a reporter there. And he was upset about, come on, immigrants. There's a right way and they're doing it in the wrong way, and our black Muslim president is trying to bring this country down, and he's doing a very good job with all of his lap dogs. At the time, he was holding a sign that said, "They rape, kill, destroy." Mm-hmm. Now, remember, this is Montana, and it's not known as a liberal bastion. Well, so from just, you know, like rape, kill, destroy, our black Muslim president, you would not be, it would not be surprising if you heard words like that and said, oh, well, look, he's a maggot. Look, he's a Trumpanzee. Huh, how about that? He's a Republican, a Libertarian, a Constitutionalist Party. He's a white winger. He's a booger eater. And you would be wrong. John Gibney, who rails against immigrants and talks about referred at one point to Barack Obama as our black Muslim president. Is a member of the Montana Green Party. The brand new, just getting started, Montana Green Party. Mm-hmm. The story gets better, though, because it has multiple morans in it. In my father's house are many morans. The Missoulian reached out to Montana Green Party chairperson Danielle Breck. And when presented with Gibney's comments regarding, well, you heard the quote, Montana Green Party chairperson Danielle Breck responded that those comments sounded, and this is a quote, somewhat bigoted. Man, it's those... it's those modifiers that'll bust your ass every time. Engaging in a racist slur, an ethnic slur, a religious slur, that was largely promulgated by the guy who presently sits at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, is... in the official word of the chair of the Montana Green Party, only somewhat bigoted. Somewhat. A little bit. Kinda. Sorta. Somewhat. But then she went on to Facebook. It only gets better. The Green Party believes in grassroots democracy and the right. Make that the responsibility of every citizen to take part in their government. We will not jump to the assumption that they are not true Green Party supporters until they have had the opportunity to show us otherwise. We hope you will do the same. No. Really. This is the party that in 2016 went around the country hooting and barking that Bernie Sanders wasn't liberal enough, that Bernie Sanders wasn't progressive enough, that only Jilly could save us. No, really. Meanwhile, the Montana Green Party also has a candidate on the ballot who has, at one time or another, been on the payroll of the Republican Party. And runs a group opposed to colleges that is, and this is a magic word, nativist. Timothy Adams is on the Green Party ticket for Senate. He's got a history of running, filing lawsuit, eligibility lawsuits and qualification lawsuits against Democrats. Re-enter Danielle Breck, who said that we've spoken to all the candidates who filed under the party's name, and we've reviewed with the candidates the Green Party's four pillars and 10 key points. We don't actually have the ability to deny candidates to file under our name. Timothy Adams has a part in running Montanans Against Higher Taxes. Now, while they've got tax in their name, what they do is they spend most of their time pissing and moaning about higher education in Montana. And they bitch about Californians coming to Montana and they want new dorms and a ski tuning room. And students party too hard. And CNN colluded with Hillary Clinton. Now, understand why. Well, the why of it is because in a hotly contested senatorial race in which Democrat John Tester will be fighting for his political life, having someone there with green behind their name, even if it turns out they're racist as hell and variously bigoted, or maybe just plain nuts, well, they've still got that green name behind them, and so there are among us, not among us, but I mean, there are precious little sparkle fart powered members of the Unicorn Cavalry Purity Brigade who'll go, I'm a voting for the green, because the green is more progressive, and we'll get to the apocarev sooner if and we can get us some greens. Never for a moment even remotely aware of the fact that the person is not going to win any office, but can only siphon votes. Beautiful, isn't it? And I tell you what, with friends like these. I guess it's a busy day for Morans today on the 19th of March, 2018. And we are an hour into the program. We still have $230 to raise. That's disturbing. No, Jim, they were not mauve clam diggers. It's not warm enough for those yet. Mm-hmm. Clarity points out, well, Bob, that's the price of being colorful. It gives the gay a way to avoid detection by wearing the prole uniform. God damn, it's all sneeches, isn't it? Just as quick as I get the star on my belly, all the snarbellied sneeches want the stars off thars. Son of a... Daggummit. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, Silent R. Lamar says, oh, please, Bob, the Montana congressperson believes white is right, Bob, and Montana, and for Montana to stay right, it must stay white, Bob. Well, I'm pretty sure there's more cattle in Montana than there are people, and I'm pretty sure they're not all white. I'm just saying. Meanwhile, with a little further explication on the law, a note coming in from Steve in New York, a member of the Fraternity of Steve. I'm listening to you talk about the Richard Simmons case. It doesn't sound like defamation per se to me if it's under California law. In that case, there must be monetary damages that flow from the defamation. Not saying that's right or wrong, but I wonder if the judge didn't have as much discretion as one might think. However, in New York, it is defamation per se. Proof of damage is not necessary. If someone defames another by saying someone is a homosexual, has a loathsome disease, negative information about one's profession, or a person is sexually promiscuous. In West Virginia, you can add to that list criminal conduct. I wonder, however, if under New York law, being accused of being transgender would be considered saying someone was homosexual. Again, I'm not trying to defend, just wondering if there's more nuance here than is apparent. Oh, there's nuance all over the place, Steve. That was kind of my point. The question, however, is even absent a showing, I mean, the judge held specifically that he was dismissing the case because it was not defamatory to say someone is transgender in his eyes. He didn't get to the question of damages. It bounced on summary judgment, I presume, if not a 12B6 motion to dismiss. I'm guessing summary judgment. But I wonder how you can get that, because clearly whether or not being transgender is a defamatory accusation is a genuine issue of material fact. And not for the judge to interpose his own well-intended opinion on. Does that make any sense? This just seems like one of those cases they tell you about on the first day of 1L. You know, the one about hard cases make bad law. This is an attempt to do a decent thing by creating an untenable result. Meanwhile, Steve in New York says, all right, let's get off the mat, people. $20 challenge on the table. So we can knock that $320 down to $280 if somebody will respond to Steve in New York's $20 challenge. Thank you, Steve. Thank you very kindly. Oh, yes, and Steve says, don't forget dear Pooty Poot. Oh, Pooty Poot had an election this weekend. And we're not sure, but given the fact that it was an entirely phony election, we don't know if he won by 99.9% of the vote or only 99.89% of the vote. Because his election in Mother Russia is free election. It does not cost you to vote in it. You just have only one vote. And you must use it wisely. Yes. Oh, well. So, again, let's take a break. Maybe knock down that $20 challenge and see where you want to go with the conversation. You are more than welcome to jump into it. I welcome your participation. I look forward to your participation. You know how to reach the program. 304-574-8178. 304-574-8178. If you need us to pay the freight toll-free, well, that number is 844 the horn, 844-843-4676. And, of course, from anywhere on the planet, you can always reach the program Skype to Skype, Bob Kincaid Horn, B-O-B-K-I-N-C-A-I-D-H-O-R-N. And if you've never sent me a contact request before and we aren't already hooked up on Skype, well, send me one. And if you want to be a first-time caller, gosh, we give out free jingles of the cowbell for that. Sorry, Jim. No. Jim says Simmons must have another avenue. Opinions can be overturned. He could theoretically appeal, but judges have in their rulings such as that are given great deference. So most likely he's just SOL, and so much for that. Equity will not tolerate a wrong without a remedy. Not in the 21st century. Yeah. The race is not always to the swift, nor the battle to the strong, but that's the way equity bets. Meanwhile, Ron and Raleigh noting, Bob, according to reports, Vlad won with 76% of the vote. He must be slipping.
I'm trying to make Mother Russia look a little more democratically. Yes, da.
And so, on this 19th day of March, 2018, break time, more in Monday. I'm Bob. We'll be back. You can't put Missoula in a newspaper article without me thinking of, well. Curse of the old DJ. I'm Bob.
I guess it all blew up in Missoula. There just was no other way. After months of going crazy, there was nothing left to say. But when the dust had finally settled and the air quickly clear. Whoa, things were better off than I had feared. And I miss you so badly. Girl, I love you madly. Feeling so sad now since I've been gone. Gone, gone, and then it's quite confusing. Seems that I'm losing track of the long distance I've been on. We're staying in a Holiday Inn full of surgeons. I guess they meet there once a year. They exchange physician stories and get drunk on two-bird beer. Then they're off to catch a stripper with their eyes glued to her cheek. But I don't think that I would ever let them cut on me. And I miss you so badly. Girl, I love you madly. I think I've been had though for staying so long. Thank you. I'm rolling.
I guess that song's a little dated, what with references to the Gong Show in it, but the thing I really want to know is there still, I mean, the images of a bunch of surgeons wasted on Tuborg beer, well, one, that's distressing, but two, is there still such a thing as Tuborg beer? I remember Tuborg Gold. Tuborg Gold was big back when we had to drive to the Tennessee state line to buy it illegally and underage and stuff. Of course, we never had money for Tuborg. We bought Carling Black Label at, what, I think $4.75 a case or something like that. Ooh, geezer moment. Yeah. But and hey, thanks very kindly to Ralphs. Thank you, Ralphs. I can proudly announce that Stephen New York's challenge has been met. So we have crossed under the $200 mark. We had $190 to go for the evening. That's 10 at 19, 19 at 10, 1 at 190. Oh, dear God. 2 at 95. 4, oh, shit. Well, never. Look, somebody just buy the 90-day supply of Crayatic Kraut, and we'll have this taken care of, would you? Okay. Note coming in from Lee in New York. From yesterday's electoralvote.com, he would prefer to collect at least 30 or 40 million votes from Russia's 109 million eligible voters, but because the outcome is preordained, people might not show up to vote. It's considerably less impressive if you win when only 10% or 15% of the voters actually bothered to vote for you. How do you get people to vote when their votes truly do not count? Well, as Asa points out, Pooty Poot gives an entirely new meaning to one man, one vote, don't he? P.S. You're goddamn ponerized is what you are. Probably so. Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, the answer is easy as far as how do you get people to vote when their votes truly don't count? Well, it's just like it's like the sign outside the old vaudeville theater in One Froggy Evening. You paint a sign that says free beer, or maybe free vodka. That's what your commie drinks, isn't it, Mandrake? Vodka? You'll notice I never drink anything but alcohol, pure grain alcohol and rainwater. Protects my precious bodily fluids. Ah, yes, Jack, that's what we need, a little cold water on the back of the neck in the code. Oh, dear. Oh, dear. Okay, well, I don't want to keep anybody. Let's see what's rattling around in Jim's noggin this fine evening. Hey, Jim.
Feed me, Bob. Feed me.
Feed me, man. How is that, Jack? And I was feeding you, and you said, feed me, Mandrake, and I fed you. Yes, Jack.
Lord, listen, I can tell you what happened to you the other day in the store. I warned you about wearing those sunglasses on the back of your head.
Was that what it was? Because I'm forever putting my glasses up on top of my noggin.
Oh, listen. That's
really?
A sure sign of membership.
No, quit it.
Quit it? No. I don't know what I'm talking about.
Well, I mean, I know you get the gay agenda every day and everything, but what am I supposed to do? And in the store, it's not my sunglasses. It's my regular eyeglasses, but I can't see shit with them on up close. I have to put them up on top of my head if I want to be able to read a computer screen or anything.
No, I'm talking about way back on the back of your head, like on the center of your scalp.
I don't know that I do that, but, I mean, I've been known to park them up there from time to time.
I don't know either, but I figured
it would create less of an impression than getting those librarian chains and just hanging them on my chest.
Well, it might do for you to get some of those things and just hang them right on your chest. I don't know. I just remember one time.
Stop talking about my chest, Jim.
Well, you know, I'm a remote viewer. I can see it. And you've got that nipple ring just not right. But nonetheless.
Well, that's what I told the piercing guy, but damn it, he insisted.
Oh, Lord, have mercy on my soul. I don't know. One quick story, and then to the real, as Elizabeth Taylor would say, the real meat of things. That's ugly, Martha. But anyway.
That's ugly, Martha. Wait a minute.
I was in a liquor store, and there was a real good-looking, nice guy who was like a student who was the cashier, and these two gay guys were ahead of me. And they had these bottles of Jose Cuervo, and one of them said to the other, right in front of this guy, I think to embarrass him, says, "Ooh, Cuervo, something for us." I just kind of stood there rooted. And I was looking to see.
Only you, Jim. Only you.
They said, "Oh, Cuervo, something for us." And I said, "The morning like that," and trying to embarrass that good looking young man. That's not right. But, you know, going back to the thing with Richard Simmons, I don't care what anybody says. That man has been harmed in every way possible. His business, his viewing numbers, and he's worked all his life trying to promote fitness and stuff like that. And, of course, I don't give a damn what kind of community that school judge lives in. He knew damn well what he was doing and damn well what the ramifications of that would be. And he knew damn well, and living in the 21st century in this country, that being transgendered is and can present a clear and present danger to a person's safety and well-being. God damn, did you ever hear of Matthew Shepard or any of the other gay hate cases and stuff like that? They all seem to be in one string right after the other.
Well, you and I are kind of on the same page where that's concerned. Like I said, if he'd filed it in Mississippi, maybe he would have won.
Well, does that make any difference? Can he not have relief before the Supreme Court of the United States?
No.
Now, one judge.
You don't just get to go to the Supreme Court, Jim.
Well, what court is after the Fifth Circuit? Supreme Court?
No, he's in this case took place in Circuit Court in L.A. It's a state court.
Okay.
So I don't Billable Rick could tell us. I don't know if there is a court of intermediate appeals in California. I would imagine there is.
Well, I would
and then up to the California Supreme Court. But there are standards that are applied to a judge's ruling that suggest that this judge would probably not be overruled in this. And the thing is, if he had, ruled in Simmons's favor, he very well may have had a couple of thousand pissed off activists around his courthouse, holding signs saying, "How dare you do exactly what he said he would not do," the specific words being, this court will not validate those prejudices by legally recognizing them.
Well, that's the only way those prejudices can be corrected.
Nope, we're just going to look the other way. We're going to look forward and not back.
No. I don't agree with that at all.
Well, I didn't say I agree. I said that's how he's treating it.
Well, this man must have, Richard Simmons, I have a great deal of respect for him and what he's doing. And he is the real McCoy. He's not some type of trickster or something like that. I mean, he's worked his ass off all of his life to try to promote healthier lifestyles, eating,
and make people feel good, and make people
like
feel
that.
Good about themselves.
Okay, on his side. On the other side of the magazine, what are they famous for? Defamation, printing absolutely bogus stories about people. Worse than that magazine in the 50s called Confidential. That's exactly what they are an outgrowth of, in my opinion.
Well, actually, if you want the counterpoint to this, consider what happened to Gawker. And I don't know if you know what Gawker is.
No, I know.
But it was a website, and it was put out of business by Hulk Hogan, who had lawyering and money help from a gay man in Silicon Valley who was pissed off that they had outed him.
And Hulk Hogan?
No, the billionaire, and he's a Trumpanzee too, the billionaire from Silicon Valley. So what happened is they sued Gawker, and get this, okay, it was all about a sex tape, and it was about Hulk Hogan's former buddy, a character from the radio named Bubba the Love Sponge. No, really.
I'm just kind of overwhelmed.
And so there was a tape of Hulk Hogan and his wife getting it on, which Hulk Hogan gave to Bubba the Love Sponge. I think I'm getting this right. And then it was published, and then it was published by Gawker. Well, Gawker was put out of business for that. But on the other hand, you know, if you're Richard Simmons, who's tried to do decently by people all of his life, well, no, he gets no recourse when he gets sleazed by the National Enquirer. Yes, well, I think that would be Peter Thiel. Thank you, Marty.
My God. When I think of the discretionary spending that is available at the checkout counter and some of these magazines that I've seen there, the Star, the Globe, the National Enquirer, and then there are people who actually take subscriptions to these things. And I don't know why they read them. It's because they're bored. Because anybody with any one piece of cockeyed sense would know this can't be true. And these magazines have an entire litany of court cases that have been filed against them for harmful defamation of character and, you know, endangerment of a person's not only their means of making a living, but their means of staying on this earth. I mean, goddamn. Does somebody not put a copy of that paper on his desk and show him the other stuff that's in there? Now think about it. I mean, you've got to be practical about this. And what was in his mind, I don't know. That judge does not need to be in. He does not need to be a judge. He needs to be sent to some institution where they can correct him.
Well,
are you there?
Yeah, he's just going to sit right there on the bench.
No, this thing can't stop there. Now, Richard Simmons is going to have to pay $200,000 in attorney's fees for the worst rag in the history of this country.
Yes.
There's got to be some relief. Maybe Bill Borick, who is an attorney in the state of California or Los Angeles, can offer some information.
Well, I'm guessing here, but I'm guessing Billable Rick is going to say the same thing I did. I mean, the order's gone final. The appeal period's probably run, and maybe he could appeal the amount of the attorney's fees because his lawyer did refer to it as a billing fiesta.
Well, of course, that's what it all is. You know, with these lawyers and stuff like that, and the way they bill clients and stuff like this, it's just, oh, God, it's just a new priesthood of robbers. And, you know, I don't know how a lawyer bills a client. Now, from what I've been told, now correct me if I'm wrong, any time that you spend on thinking about a client or that client's case, you can legally bill him that amount, can you not?
If it's related to the case and reasonably related, yeah, it's billable.
Even if you're standing there shaving in front of a mirror and you're thinking about that, you can still bill that 30 minutes that you stood shaving in front of a mirror or the time you took to drive.
That's why
that's
why they refer to a law license as a license to print money.
Well, you know, that's great. Now, I remember that movie called The Firm. And they brought this out in that movie, and it showed how this terribly illegitimate law firm representing, the mafia, how they would overbill clients. And then they would put that bill in an envelope and put a stamp on it and mail it to the client. Now, according to this movie, now I'm not trying to preach Hollywood here. I'm just trying to gather some information. It would appear when you put something in an envelope and you put it in the U.S. mail, and that is not a legitimate thing, you are guilty of mail fraud. Is that not true?
I'm not particularly up on it, but I remember the plot of The Firm, and that was the assertion. Yes.
Yeah, five to ten. I mean, you got to be damn careful that what you put in the mail and what you send out. Because if they can find out that you have sent something that is not legitimate and use the mail service, then you have got a whole lot of problems. It's just going to rain on your day forever. But I was just shocked to hear this, and surely to God, Simmons must have some kind of relief, even to come out later and just, I mean, how could the man prove that he's not a transsexual? I mean, what could he do? He can have a doctor.
Well, you can't prove a negative. It's not for him to prove that. It would be in that case, it would be for him to prove that they acted with as the suit papers claimed, calculated malice
and forethought. Of course, they did. In order to print it, they realized that this would be their trajectory, and luckily, their projectile landed in the right place. Well, there's just got to be some relief a person can have from that, because just one person's decision, I mean, that's just, surely to God, what rank is this judge?
He is a Los Angeles County Superior Court judge. He is God Almighty in the trial court system. He is one of many God Almighties in the trial court system of the state of California.
We don't need people like that. We don't need people like that. There's got to be some relief from that. I mean, I would prefer that they do away with the jury altogether and have a triumvirate. It's the way they did in other places, had done in other places. Because the jury didn't even get to hear the case.
Nope.
Now, isn't it your right to have a trial by a group of your peers?
You have that constitutional right. But your case has to rise to the level where it can get to a jury. This never made it past summary judgment or motion to dismiss or whatever it was bounced on.
Hey, was the jury sitting right there in the courtroom?
No,
or had the jury,
no. This
the
is all
jury had
no,
not been impaneled.
No, this it hadn't been impaneled. This is all what's called motion practice.
Well, wouldn't it have been better for Summons' lawyer to have requested a jury trial?
I'm sure he did, but that doesn't mean that the minute that no, there you have discovery and you have motion practice, and before you ever get to a jury, well, the case has to be found to have enough merit to get a question of fact to the jury.
Well, I would think that the amounts of money involved in litigation would at least lend that much gravitas to allowing it to come before a group of 12 men and women?
Depending on which jurisdiction, there may not even be a dollar amount placed in the ad damnum clause. It may just say compensated sufficiently to make him whole or right the wrong or something like that. Dollar figure, just saying I want, like Dr. Evil, $1 million, it doesn't get you to a jury.
Well, to be made whole does require the payment of, or the non-payment of $200,000.
Well, that's not what he sued for. That's what they billed for, Jim.
Well, this is just amazing to me. Absolutely. It just undermines every bit, every article of faith I have in the current judicial system and in the legal system as well. And, lawyers are just... they're incredibly adept at being able to, they have a license to rob, lie, cheat, and steal. And that is the reputation they have. And there are very few of them who are not practicing, who would not fall into that category, because each one would grab something like that and it'll attack the cows or whatever, just trying to pull himself out, and even at the wrongdoing of the client or the litigant. I just don't see it. I mean, I've heard of a lot of wild-ass case decisions in my life, but I've never heard of one like this.
Well, if you're a public figure, the American system makes it decidedly difficult to sue a media outlet because you have chosen to put yourself in the public eye. This is the way the theory goes. You've chosen to put yourself in the public eye, and therefore anything short of actual malice isn't actionable. That's why that calculated malice had to, that allegation had to be in the suit papers. You know, this comes, yeah. Among other things, the latest iteration of this rule comes from a case called Falwell v. Hustler.
Oh, dear God, him.
Jerry Falwell sued,
I remember,
Hustler magazine and Larry Flint, the movie The People versus Larry Flint is based on it.
Campari.
After Hustler published a biting satire of Hustler of Falwell, in which it was suggested that Falwell used to have sex with his own mama. This of course outraged Jerry Falwell.
Now wait a minute. I thought this thing got started when Hustler had published an advertisement for Campari with Jerry Falwell.
Yeah, it was a parody, Jim.
I know. But is this where this thing got its roots, basically?
That's where the Hustler v. Falwell doctrine comes from.
Well, I love Campari. It's wonderful. I don't know if you like it, but it's just the most wonderful drink in the world as far as an aperitif is concerned.
Well, this wasn't that. This was Jerry Campari had a series of ads called So-and-So Talks About His First Time. It's the first time you had Campari or whatever.
Mm-hmm. And made from wormwood.
I thought that was absinthe, but anyway.
It's still Campari has. Yeah, that's
at the bottom of the page, it said, ad parody, not to be taken seriously. It had Falwell saying things like, I always get sloshed before I go out to the pulpit. You don't think I could lay down all that bullshit sober, do you?
Jerry.
Let's see, what else? Just reading from the Wikipedia entry. Included a headshot photo of Falwell and the transcript of a spoof interview where, misunderstanding the interviewer's question about his first time, Falwell casually shares details about his first sexual encounter, an incestuous rendezvous with his mother in the family outhouse while they were both drunk off our God-fearing asses on Campari. In the spoof interview, Falwell goes on to say he was so intoxicated that Mom looked better than a Baptist whore with a $100 donation, and he decided to have sex with her because she had showed all the other guys in town such a good time.
Oh, dear. Lord have mercy.
And the interviewer says, did you ever try it again? And Falwell responds, sure, lots of times, but not in the outhouse. Between Mom and the shit, the flies were too much to bear. I mean, it was vicious. It was vicious.
What year was that, did you hear Wikipedia tell you?
The November 1983 issue of Hustler.
Now it's coming to...
And so, because you can say that about Jerry Falwell, you can say Richard Simmons is transgender.
You know, I'm just having a real hard time making that connection. Maybe it was good that I went on to study another discipline other than law, because I'm sure if I had gotten a law degree and been practicing law, I'd probably be behind bars now.
Well, here's the thing. Like I said, on the first day of the first week of the first semester of the first class, that you take in law school, some hoary, H-O-A-R-Y, old law professor will stand up there with trembling hands, and he'll say something like, "Hard cases make bad law." And then he'll say, "But Oliver Wendell Holmes, Jr. said, it is possible to live greatly in the law." And you're off and running. Hard cases make bad law, Jim, means that when you've got a decision, when you've got a set of facts that are going to yield an unpalatable decision, you're going to wind up with a rule of law coming out of it that nobody's going to like.
Well, I can remember some other cases that Oliver Wendell Holmes ruled on that were upheld in that movie, A Judgment at Nuremberg, by Hale Roth, played by Maximilian Schell.
Well, among other things, Oliver Wendell Holmes was a eugenicist. He ruled, five generations of imbeciles is enough in justifying the... Three generations of imbeciles is enough in justifying the forced involuntary sterilization of women.
I think that was incorporated into the 1935 Nuremberg Laws. And it was written by, I know the name of the author. He was also present at the Nuremberg and the Wannsee Conference. He was an eminent scholar of the law and was in the Ministry of the Interior. Was later killed in 1953 in a mysterious automobile wreck. But I remember that was pointed out when he was trying to sit there in the that film called, which basically outlined what happened at Wannsee for those 2 hours or whatever when they decided on the final solution. And this guy was arguing with Heydrich, saying, you know, you can't do all this because it's too fast. It overwhelms the precedent of law and the civil courts, the intricacies of the law. Of course, Heydrich said he would be Alexandrian about it. He just cut it all with one knife and just send them all to the gas chamber. That's basically it. But I didn't mean to get off on that. I didn't. But, you know, something like this really upsets me because I've always been an admirer of Richard Simmons, as I said before. And when you have a filthy pulp rag that isn't even worth of the smelliest outhouse in the worst part of wherever, and yet you've got people who have it sitting right there in the magazine, sitting right there in the magazine rack next to their easy chair. And what would amaze you, and I just wonder, and this is just I'm wondering as I normally do, I just wonder how many of Trump's base are subscribers to these rags, and what percentage of that 30% really believe the crap they believe in the pages of the famous gospel truth.
There's no answer to that question.
I remember I played a joke on my mother and gave her a subscription to it.
She must have loved you dearly for it.
She did. She would just call me on the phone and she said, "I can't believe what they're saying in here." And, you know, they had everything in there. If it wasn't Elvis, it was Anne Margaret. If it wasn't a two-headed baby or...
Oh, there was a while there in the National Enquirer. You couldn't see it in the grocery store without it had a picture of, oh, dear God, I am dating myself, of Burt Reynolds and Lonnie Anderson for a while. Or Burt Reynolds and Sally Fields. Burt Reynolds.
Burt Reynolds and his toupee. Oh, yeah. That was another thing that was always coming up, why it couldn't blow off in those scenes while he was taking his head out of the car. But I guess when people... Now, I knew my mother's scale of little intellect and knew that she would accept it as a joke. And basically, you know, we used to just laugh. And she said, "I'm glad you've given me something to use in case we run out of toilet paper, because that's the only thing it is worth." And I know my dad would come home, and he would see that, and this, they had this big brass ring thing with all the periodicals and stuff. And he would see that, I can hear him, and I'd say, Helen, what is this doing here? Like, Jim, your son gave it to me as a Christmas present. Figures.
Figures. Well, Jim, it's good talking to you. You have yourself a good evening now, all right?
I'll do my best. One more thing about the Russian election.
Yes.
I mean, how many candidates ran against him? They had a whole spiel. It looks like 12 people participated in the exercise of futility.
Well, but the thing is, the one person who was a legitimate challenger to him was not permitted to run.
Well, you know, Bob, one thing about a Russian election these days, there is never a shortage of skim milk to be put in pens on ballots.
Well said. Well said. Jim, take care of yourself. You have a good night now.
Well, same to you. And by the way, watch those glasses now.
Oh, I will. I absolutely will. Yes. Now that I know, I'll just have to leave them in the car maybe or something. Didn't want to give
and
people
just
the wrong
don't wiggle
idea.
When you walk now.
Jim, I have not wiggled when I walked since I started. Yeah, I'll watch that, Jim. Have a good night.
Good night.
Later. Like I said, the clam diggers don't come out until when it gets warmed up some. Never a dull moment. And we are still at $190 to go in fundraising for the evening, about 18 minutes before the hour. And let's check in real quick with Scott and Punky. I got a couple other stories I want to get to, but let's see what they've got. Hey, Scott.
Hey, Bob. A couple of quick things about the Inquirer.
Yes.
And the Falwell case. First and foremost, if you have for people with Netflix, 2015, there was a pretty good documentary by Rick Burns, Ken Burns' brother, called Inquiring Minds, and it gives the history of the Inquirer, and it's pretty good. I'm only sorry that he didn't wait a few years to bring the Trump connection into the story. But back in the 70s, the Inquirer reported at a restaurant, I believe in D.C. or somewhere, that Carol Burnett, they alleged, was drunk. And she took him to court, and I believe she prevailed. So they can be beaten.
Yeah, I think Mary Tyler Moore successfully sued them, too.
Yeah, probably. And I think Johnny Carson had a go with him some years back. But the case about Falwell had another aspect that was interesting. You said it was November of 83 that they ran the parody ad, the Campari ad?
Yeah.
Okay. Apparently, obviously, down in Lynchburg, Jerry Falwell took great umbrage at such a thing. And in one of his subsequent fundraising letters, he copied the in his fundraising appeal. So he was countersued by Larry Flint's company for copyright infringement. And I don't think that was part of the Supreme Court case, but it was quite satisfying. As sleazy as the Hustler is, parody is a protected form of speech.
Well, it absolutely is. But and that's the thing. There was nothing. There was no parody about. It was reported as fact in this particular case. And you know,
with Richard Simmons,
right? Yeah.
Here's the other thing, and I'm mystified by your experience in the store. When the guy called you
that word.
A gay, that word, a gay slur name. I don't think it was the glasses on top of your head, and Jim could probably chime in on this. Seems to me, or the question is, did you have a bright colored handkerchief?
No, you know, I didn't. I can say that. And in fact, even if I had, my jacket would have covered it up, but I didn't.
Okay, so we can safely say it wasn't that.
No, it's just a pair of pastel colored Levi's, that's all.
Yeah, I don't know if the hanky code is still a thing, but back in the 70s, I recall, the color indicated something, and the pocket and the side of your back pants pockets that the colored hanky was sticking out of indicated something. Let's just put it that way, your preference, so to speak. But anyway.
Yeah. Okay, no.
Okay, all right. Well, but anyway, yeah, I've got to find the People versus Larry Flynt, because I thought it did quite a good job of detailing that case, and I must watch that again sometime.
You know, of all the people, I don't know what his health's like these days, but of all the people out there, you'd think that if somebody could have gotten their hands on the PP tape, it would have been Larry Flynt, and maybe he put a bounty out on it. I don't know.
Oh, well, he does that. I mean, you remember that Korean Air plane that was shot down by the Soviets back in the, I guess, the 80s?
Yeah.
One of the passengers on that plane, all the people were killed, obviously, but one of the passengers was a Georgia congressman by the name of Larry something. And apparently the hustler... He was one of these moral indignation types. And the hustler, I forget whether it's before he died or after, published photographs of him in a compromising position with someone who was not his wife. And they put, I believe, when it became obvious that Trump was going to be the Republican nominee, I believe it's a standing thing. The hustler puts out a bounty on any incriminating evidence on these jokers.
Well, what's interesting, though, is that no bounty may any longer be necessary. One, we are now less than a week away from the great big, oh my God, monumental Stormy Daniels interview with Anderson Vanderbilt Cooper.
Yeah.
Over on the CBS.
Yeah, 60 Minutes.
Right. And then there's this thing that Channel 4 in the UK... has done. They're apparently respected, Channel 4 is, for their investigative reporting, and they ran a sting on a guy named Alexander Nix, the CEO of one Cambridge Analytica.
Oh yeah, I read about that.
And it turns out that Cambridge Analytica, and this is more news of the day, certainly has far more impact and more gravitas, I guess, than some of the other stuff I've talked about thus far this evening. But Nix is a man. Nix is a moron, because he was talking to a reporter and just started going off and saying that one of the things Cambridge Analytica liked to do would be to send some girls around to the candidate's house. You know, some Ukrainian girls, they're very beautiful. I find that works well. And we'd work through a series of front companies and subcontractors and offer a large amount of money to the candidate. We'll have the whole thing recorded. We'll blank out the face of our guy and we'll post it on the internet. In other words, the very stuff that is said to have been done to Donald Trump.
Yeah.
With the PP tape, and him getting a withered old member jumping like a snake in a microwave, very small snake, probably just a worm really, by watching prostitutes urinate on the bed that Barack Obama had slept in. We just put the information into the bloodstream of the internet and then watch it grow. Give it a little push now and again, Turnbull said. It has to happen without anyone thinking that's propaganda, because the moment you think that's propaganda, the next question is, who's put that out? And the executive then, according to Think Progress, went on to boast the Cambridge Analytica had worked in more than 200 elections across the world. The fundamental human drivers when it comes to taking information on board effectively are hopes and fears, and many of those are unspoken and even unconscious. You didn't know that was a fear until you saw something that evoked that reaction from you, and our job is to drop the bucket further down the well than anybody else to understand what really are those deep-seated underlying fears. Now, this is an executive for Cambridge Analytica. The managing director of Cambridge Analytica Political Global, Mark Turnbull, said that, that's just all propaganda. That's what he was talking about. Ah, it's propaganda. Yeah, you're just trying to ruin Cambridge Analytical. Well, the thing is, Scott, Cambridge Analytical, according to The Guardian and The New York Times, they scammed up and hoovered up about 50 million Facebook users' personal information in order to micro-target voters for the 2016 election. And they are, of course, also part of the Mueller investigation.
Yeah. Well, hopefully all of this will come out beyond a shadow of a doubt come out. And it's not going to convince Trump's 32% or whatever it is, but certainly it should convince some people somewhere that there's just something stinky rotten in the whole Trump campaign and afterwards presidency. I sincerely hope, because otherwise, I mean, the other night I was watching an interview. It was an in-depth program on C-SPAN Book TV. John Dean was on there. And say what you will about John Dean, he certainly came out of the whole Nixon administration and Watergate situation a better person. And he was talking about just how vile and corrupt it is. And I don't know if he's chimed in yet on the state of things with Trump, but he had three very good books during the Reign of Error, so he ought to be able to squeeze out at least one book so far about Trump's shenanigans. And I would take to the bank anything that he has to say about it, because, I'm not real big on heroes, but in terms of Watergate and giving his testimony to the Senate Watergate Committee and his writing since, he's a straight-ahead guy in my book.
Well, the other portion of this particular story is something that broke right before airtime, and I think you saw it too.
Yeah.
That the chief information security officer of Facebook has said, screw it, I quit.
Yeah, I did see that.
And he's leaving Facebook because of what are described by the New York Times as internal disagreements over how the social network should deal with its role in spreading disinformation. Now, personally, I think Mark Zuckerberg should probably go and, jump in the Mariana Trench with the, and do the honorable thing, because he and his lust for profit and power did untold amounts of harm to whatever future this nation might have had.
Well, and speaking of Facebook, there was another story today having to do with the growing bipartisan outrage of some of these things, and wanting to bring Zuckerberg and other executives from Facebook to the Hill to testify before these various committees. It reminds me, Bob, of that game. I guess it was big in the 80s or the 70s or something. It's a bunch of wooden pieces, and you stack them up.
Jenga.
And is that what it is? Okay, I couldn't remember the name. Where each player takes turns pulling out a piece, hoping that it will strategically destabilize the stack of wooden pieces, so that when the opponent pulls out his next piece, the whole stack comes falling down. And that's, you know, it's kind of a drip, drip, drip thing.
Well, in this particular case, what's important to know is that Alex Stamos is not quitting because Facebook wants to be more transparent and he wants to put up a wall. No, it's the exact opposite. Alex Stamos recognizes how profound and how grim was Facebook's role, and he has argued in favor of investigating and then disclosing what the Russians did on Facebook. This has caused people like Mark Zuckerberg and the chief operating officer, Sheryl Sandberg, to have a conniption.
Yeah, to say the least. And that's the good thing. If there's any good that will come out of it, it'll be whatever number of honorable people to whom the stench will have become overwhelming, and they'll have no other choice but to come forward with everything they know.
Among other things, his security team is being diluted and integrated into the Facebook product and infrastructure divisions. Now, just let that settle in for a minute. They're not going to have a security division anymore. That'll just be part of the product division or the infrastructure division. And his group that used to have 120 people is now down to 3.
What does Facebook think it is? Congress? In terms of oversight and responsible reactions? I mean, come on.
Yeah. But, I mean, this is disturbing stuff, of course. The other question is, since he's leaving, does he become dangerous? Does he become somebody that, since Mueller's already investigating the Facebook-Russia angle, does he become somebody that they want to have a long, serious conversation with? I mean, I would think.
One would hope. And then the other aspect is, if the moth gets too close to the flame, or the various moths get too close to the flame, who the hell knows what Putin and his operatives might do with some kind of nerve agent or other thing? It needn't be chemical warfare. They've pushed people off of balconies. They've shot people. They've stabbed people.
Now, you know. Stop that. We all know that they're all cuddly and snuggly and wouldn't hurt a fly.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, of course.
But here's the interesting question, since we've been talking about a little bit of legal stuff this evening. There are 50 million people who, without their knowledge or their consent, got their personal data hoovered up by Cambridge Analytica. Now, think back to data, the security breaches, say, at what, Experian?
No, I was just going to say that.
And think in terms of what would a class action suit against of 50 million people against Facebook and Cambridge Analytica do?
Well, and how did that operation work, or do we even know? Because what I'm wondering, you think back to once the candidates, wait a minute, come here, punk. I was trying to pick him up and he jumped off. Come on, buddy. Wait a minute. What, we probably don't know yet, but I'm thinking back to after the candidates had been decided in 2016, that space between the conventions and Election Day, that's when I think the Russian influence online really went full tilt boogie, because all of these Facebook groups and posts were popping up, and I even got sucked in on one of them, anti-Trump and but also anti-Hillary. There were even some anti-Bernie ones or some that were in favor of Bernie. So I finally decided not to click or join any of those because it just it didn't pass the smell test, if you recall those types of posts.
Oh, I do, I do, I do. Well, okay, so the key in what they did is in the phrase micro-targeting, Scott. In other words, what they did is they were able to use Facebook, Cambridge Analytica was, to delve, I mean, to do a deep dive into people's preferences, their prejudices, their fears, their bigotries, and they micro-targeted down to street and house levels. They manipulated what Facebook does. I mean, anybody who's on Facebook, you know that there's really no rhyme or reason for understanding how it works. I mean, for instance, I have a couple of thousand friends on Facebook, and anytime somebody that's on my friends list publishes a photograph of Donald fucking Trump, Facebook's face recognition algorithms automatically, without the person doing the posting even doing anything, automatically tags me because they think, for some reason or another, Facebook's algorithms think I'm Donald Trump or that I look a lot like Donald Trump, which I find nauseating in the extreme. It's enough to make me go and break my nose and shave my head and you know, get facial deconstruction surgery or something.
Well, it's not only nauseating, it's absurd because I don't see any result. There's, I mean, you'd have to be halfway legally blind to think that you look anything like Trump. I mean, come on.
But the idea, you know, I want to, and you don't know how much of this is going to come out so that it can be actionable. But I guess the argument by Facebook would be, because if you ever read their EULA, it's a piece of work. It'll say that you give them the right to do any goddamn thing in the world they want to do with your data, because it's not your data anymore, it's Facebook's.
Yeah. Well, here's another thing I don't understand. These people at Cambridge Analytica ought to be working in Facebook's advertising department as legitimate employees, because they're a hell of a lot more effective targeting people. I mean, I can't tell you, and it goes in cycles. Some days I'll go like a week, 2 weeks without getting one, and then all of a sudden, every day, every hour, there's a new flurry of ads that show up in my feed on Facebook, virtually none of which to me. And algorithm or whatever that they're using, they need to make some adjustments, because I have, in all the time I've been using Facebook, with the exception of one or two items, I have never encountered an ad that pops up in my timeline or page, whatever,
that's even remotely relevant to anything you're interested in.
Yeah, I mean, and you wouldn't believe some of the misses that they send my way, and how they think that I have any discernible interest. I mean, you could turn the Hubble telescope around and focus it on me on high magnification, high depth, and I doubt that even the Hubble could discern any interest on my part with a lot of virtually all of these ads.
Amazing. Yeah.
Okay.
Brother Deacon Asa points out that Alex Stamos there at Facebook, if you recall, was previously the chief security officer at Yahoo. He left Yahoo when his team discovered the $2 billion account hack job, and Yahoo internally decided not to come clean. Well, I didn't recall that, but I just thought he was adorable interacting with the little Olsen twins on that Full House show back in the 90s.
No, that's John Stamos.
Oh, okay.
but that thing with Yahoo, weren't there several billion emails hacked? Is that the same incident?
Yeah, the 2 billion account hack job.
Jesus. It's enough to make you want to get offline. Maybe that's the point.
But what would the world do without Facebook? See, I remember a time without Facebook. That was a time when everybody was on MySpace.
No, I never did MySpace.
Oh, God, what a nightmare that was.
My thing before Facebook, from like 2003 until, I don't know, 7 years ago or so when I signed up with Facebook, was LiveJournal. And you know who owns them? That's LiveJournal is owned by the Russians. So who knows where my material is going out to with that? I mean, it's like I say, one part of me thinks, you know, today may be the day to just get offline, or at least off of Facebook. Because it's you talk about diminishing returns. And there's no break in the politics. Not that I'm against politics, but I'm against, sooner or later, there's a fatigue factor that sets in, that you just like, you get up and you're almost afraid to fire up the computer because it's going to be just the same nonsense. But anyway, that's... I didn't want to go too far down the rabbit hole, but I wanted to pass along a couple of thoughts about the Falwell thing in Hustler and the Hanky Code. So let that be my.
Yes. you got an update on the Hanky Code from Jim. He said Jim said yeah, the Hanky Code is in still in use, still in vogue. He said the Navy should use them as semaphores. Oh, dear God.
Well, there used to be a thing also with
Jim.
Keys.
Jim went pro this evening. Yeah, he really, really, really did.
What was that line that I laughed out loud. Damn, I'll have to listen to the replay.
Well, Jim always brings it.
Well, there's something that he said that just absolutely cracked me up. I'll listen to the replay. But anyway, that'll be my little contribution to the Horn family today. And you watch. As soon as I hang up, Punky will get as quiet as the proverbial church mouse.
He hasn't bothered me in the least. And by the way, one word. Squidbillies.
Squidbillies. I knew you were going there.
No, you started. It's the new bit. I have to do it with every call.
Yes, I know. But it's... Somehow the Lebowski was way more fun because now I have no excuse since somebody sent you the link and you sent it to me, so I need to get on it.
Yeah, you've got to come up. It makes it harder to come up with credible excuses, right?
Bingo.
Yeah, Punky ate my computer is not going to fly.
Yeah. Punky, hush.
All right, well, I enjoyed the conversation. Scott, you take care of yourself, and we will talk soon.
Okay, and if you change your mind, Bob, and want to buy a cockatiel, they're very quiet.
Yeah, I can tell.
Well-behaved and quiet.
Yes. Yeah. No, I want an African gray that swears prodigiously.
Good, because we could, in times like these, that's just what we need.
You know, I can just imagine how what an addition he would make, or she would make, to the program. Fuck with.
Well, you know who had a macaw on his radio show in Kansas City was the stock market analyst Joe Granville. I forget the bird's name, but the bird would chime in. I don't know if he picked stocks for Joe, but he would chime in from time to time. And my Lord, that was back when radio was, well, I don't know what the hell it was. I was waiting for the day when Joe Granville's parent parrot said, you know, squawk, now all you other chicken fuckers get up on the...
Yeah, what did the chicken do?
All right, Bob, I'll let you...
All right, later, Scott. Take care. Night, Punky.
See ya. Say goodnight, Punky. He's going to shut up like...
yeah, he did.
Like, you watch. He sees me getting ready to hit the off button. He's counting down the milliseconds.
All right, well, take care, Scott.
Let's not disappoint him.
All right, later.
I'll see you.
Bye now. Our buddy Scott and Punky calling from San Diego. Lee in New York reminding me, yes, Bob, there was a time before Facebook and even MySpace. When I studied for my computer science degree, the school had a Xerox Sigma 7. That model was part of the original ARPANET, the forerunner of the Internet. I programmed that computer with punch cards. Lee in New York. And immediately before that, we were chiseling our words into stone tablets, right? Isn't that how it... Yeah. I remember that thing called book. Yes. That thing called face. I mean, think about it. What a dumbass name is Facebook. The hell does that even mean? And meanwhile, it's 11 minutes past the hour. We got $190 to fundraise on this evening yet, but I need to pull the program up a little bit short. Like I said, we've got some stuff going on in the family, and I have to do some evening driving from time to time, and this is one of those times. And so rather than getting home at 1 or 2 in the morning, I need to knock off now, and that'll save me an hour or maybe two and make my life a little bit simpler. So I'm gonna close things up now, and the rest of the week should be pretty much typical, you know, ordinary. I hesitate to use the word normal because normal's only a setting on a dryer. And with that, I will ask your fond forbearance, and if you're listening to this program later, and maybe you've never contributed to the horn, maybe you've never kicked in to help keep this going, and yet you enjoy it. A $10 subscription, like I said, it works out to around 16 cents an hour. And, well, I was at the gas station one day, and I was filling up the jug for the lawnmower. This was like last summer. Because we've been talking about 16 cents an hour for a while. And I actually pumped 16 cents worth of gasoline to see what it looked like. It didn't look like much. And I've walked around and said, got anything in here for 16 cents? No. Got anything in here for 49 cents? No. Can't even get a cup of coffee for, no. So if you'd like to become a subscriber and take us a few steps closer to having those, fabulous, fantastic 400, it'd be great. Or if you just don't want to do a one time, just go to headon.live, scroll down to the PayPal button, use it, and help us keep things going here. Any amount up to and including $190, and that way we'll be done with fundraising for the evening. Note coming in from Robert in Australia. From what I'm reading, Facebook is dying. People who have used it for years are fed up with it, and new users, i.e. youths, these utes, hate it and won't touch it. They're going to other platforms. Yeah, they go to Instagram, which is owned by Facebook. But this is not good for their brand, and they've got to be having a conniption. And frankly, you know, if the one thing that might save it is the one thing that they cannot bear to countenance. Regulation. I don't know, maybe a nice lawsuit would tighten them up a little bit. Punitive damages exist for a reason. Within the law, punitive damages are a teaching tool for teaching defendants who have gotten out of control that that they are subject to the law of the land. The words punitive damages, well, the word punitive comes from the word from which we also get punish. Punishment damages. You know, this is going to hurt you more than it hurts us. Unfortunately, we have a judicial system with a decided distaste for punitive damages. All one need do is look at the history of the Exxon Valdez case, and you can learn that. But anyway, one more email. Quote, courtesy of Peaceful Tea. A quote from Thomas Paine. A body of men holding themselves accountable to nobody ought not to be trusted by anybody. And that sounds like it should probably be taken to heart. So tomorrow will be Titanic Tuesday. And it'll just be an ordinary 3-hour program. And for now, I'm going to knock off and get the program uploaded and get on the road. Thanks, everybody. Thanks to Steve, and thanks to Ralps for the challenge and the response there, too. Thank you to all our subscribers. Thank you to all of you who share your precious finite time engaged in this program in whatever way you choose. Thanks to our all-volunteer staff. Thanks this evening to Sparky in the chat room. Thank you to our news ninjas. Thank you, Brother Deacon Asa, headon.live. Thanks, John Fox in Australia. Thank you, Ben Birch, whiterosesociety.org. Glad you're feeling better. And thanks always to the hardest working, bravest people I know, the men and women of Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net. And always, 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 Gina, it's all for you. Later, y'all.